welcome to Stay Cool Forever,
the podcast where we're taking a look back at some 90s classics, looking at them from the future and seeing how well they hold up.
And I think maybe we should do a little house cleaning here right off the bat. You can check us out on Podmas, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, Google Play. We're on Spotify now.
Did you say Pippa?
Oh, and Pippa, of course. My bad. Yeah. And I'm Zach.
I'm Wade.
And we're the number 7th podcast on Podmas, so thank you.
Thanks for making that happen. And let's go for number one.
Let's go for number one. And we're the number 1 comedy podcast on Podmas. You can email us at staycoolforever@gmail.com. And you can hit me up on Twitter at LA Zachary K.
Now that Great. We got all that stuff out of the way, this series of movies we're doing are classics from classic directors. We're talking about the Oscar nominees, the heavy hitters, people you've probably heard of and seen movies from.
Yeah, they're all definite mainstream movies, some cult classics, I think. You know, all directors that are important for cinema. We're going to do Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas, Coen Brothers' Fargo, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, and today we did Spielberg's Schindler's List.
Which was, oof.
Woof.
Yeah.
Woof is definite.
I think we both were concerned with how are we going to make this fun.
Yeah.
Because it's certainly not something you can take lightly or joke about, and there's so much to unpack from a historic point of view, from a cinematic point of view.
Yeah, it is a difficult one to make fun. However, it is, I think, an important movie, and I think if we were choosing, since we chose Spielberg, I didn't really want to do Jurassic Park.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, too beloved, and it's gotten a little muddy with the reboots.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess we could have done Saving Private Ryan, but I don't think there would have been Saving Private Ryan had there not been Schindler's List.
And having seen this movie for the first time, mm-hmm. I now really see that comparison. Because I was of age when Saving Private Ryan came out.
Okay.
And I don't think I had checked out Spielberg's back catalog.
Okay.
So my experience was Saving Private Ryan, and then every, you know, sci-fi, fantasy, big kind of blockbuster,
yeah,
real stylish movie. So going back and sort of seeing him in the earlier stages of his craft, he was obviously well established at the time, but yeah. I forgot how good he was with just the world building.
No, 100%. Just absolutely fantastic. This movie actually got him his degree at USC. This really? Is technically a student film.
Oh.
He'd been taking courses under a pen name, so no one knew that it was him, and then he submitted this as his final project. He apparently didn't want to make the film, and he waited a long time to make it. It had been in the works for over 10 years.
Wow, okay.
He didn't want to make it because he didn't want to profiteer off the Holocaust.
Sure.
He called it a Jewish movie by a Jew for Jews to enlighten people about what happened in an effort to combat anti-Semitism and people who don't believe, Holocaust deniers. And so I think that's just an interesting little side note there. And it was based off of a book called Schindler's Ark.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like Noah's Ark.
Yeah. And so the way the story goes, there's a dry cleaners in Beverly Hills, and the owner of the dry cleaner is technically one of Schindler's Jews. And so he kept haranguing different people, directors and producers, and telling them the story. And at one point in time, I forget if it's Spielberg, but someone near in Spielberg's orbit was harangued by this guy and was told the story. I lied. It's the author. The author who wrote the book got stopped by this guy, told the story, and said, well, is it true? And he goes, yeah, and started putting up documents, and he had a list and all these things. And then that guy wrote the book, and then the book's rights were initially sold to MGM, and MGM never made the movie. And then it then moved on to, it ended up in Spielberg's lap, and he ended up wanting to make it and promised one of the survivors he'd make it within a decade. It never happened because, he didn't want to profiteer on the Holocaust. And when the movie ended up getting made, he used his money that he made for the film and donated it. And that's how they created the USC Shoah Foundation. And Shoah is the Hebrew word for the Holocaust. Mm. So he actually didn't make money, but he earned gravitas, if you will.
Of course. I had always thought of this as a passion project, something that he would have always wanted to make or known he always wanted to make, because mm-hmm. it is so singular and important, and there's really no other movie like it.
Yes. I think the only other comparison is... it's called the Shoah, and it's, I think it's in French, or it's in one of those Germanic languages, but it's a 10-hour oral history of the Holocaust.
Oh.
And so the film, it's Claude Lanzmann. It's a 9-hour oral history film, the Shoah, and it makes clear that what remains unseen is more powerful, because he famously criticized Schindler's List for showing the Holocaust through the eyes of a German and for turning horror into a Hollywood melodrama.
Mm.
And so I get that. I understand that, but I think it makes for a better story. Again, this is still cinema. You know, you still have to tell the story, and I don't think it devalues the work in and of itself. Okay, good.
We recording?
Yeah. I don't think it devalues the film at all. I think it needed that plot device of someone to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I guess we can move on from that little history lesson there.
The only things I could think of comparing this to movie-wise, which is a little strange, was like a mashup of Citizen Kane
mm-hmm.
and Casablanca.
Okay.
But with the inclusion of the Holocaust.
It's funny you say Casablanca, because when MGM bought it, they had initially signed on the director of Casablanca
huh.
to do it. So maybe there's some weird homage in there then.
There's definitely a similarity to me in the old Hollywood style. Obviously black and white, and mm-hmm. we're dealing with World War II occupied lands.
Yeah.
The Nazis are around, but we're going to follow some kind of upper class people who are just trying to like... keep it cool and get through it.
Yeah. And maybe make a little money.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think that's you can't make the argument that that's something evil that they did. America profiteers all the time off of wars.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean? So it's I think that's a real thing, and it's tangible, and I think that is it was a good lens to tell the story through.
Mm-hmm. That's a real interesting thing about the character of Schindler, having never seen this before. I was very curious if he was intent on saving Jews from the get-go, or if he was just being a cheap-ass war profiteer guy.
Yeah.
And whether it was something that he sympathized with later on, as he was going through and seeing, mm-hmm. you know, the human cost of all of this.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened, is there was a turn in his sort of story arc.
Mm.
Because historically speaking, Schindler employed more Poles
mm-hmm.
than he did Jews. There must have been a turn. What I'm curious is I would like to have known straight from Schindler. Like, at what point did he go, oh, fuck, we got to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he was making money. And so, you know, historically speaking, he hired more Poles before Jews, and then had a transition into getting more Jews, and then... the real Schindler admittedly didn't know the names of all the workers. He only knew a few workers that would frequent his office. And then Schindler was also never riding horseback atop a hill watching the ghetto be destroyed, because there's actually no hills outside of that ghetto.
Okay.
Which I thought was like, oh, okay. So, yeah.
But as a storytelling device,
it
again, an embellishment. And yes, that would be one of those scenes that gives you a clear sense that he is confronting
mm-hmm.
the dark reality of this and sort of coming up with his plan or committing to
yeah.
outsmarting it or undermining it.
And figuring it out. Alternatively, something that was real was the girl in the red jacket.
Yes.
That was a real girl. She's an actual girl named Roma Legaka, a survivor of that Krakow ghetto, and she was known amongst the Jews living there by her red winter coat. She's now a painter who lives in Germany and later wrote a biography about surviving the Holocaust called The Girl in the Red Coat.
Interesting. Interesting. Now the movie, of course, has her...
shows her dying at the end. And so I guess we can get to the sort of the plot devices or cinematically some aspects. The use of the lack of color.
Yes, you get it at the beginning and the end with the lighting of the candles.
Yeah.
Symbolizing kind of hope for the Jewish community.
Yeah, I think it symbolizes sort of life and a peace and a calm. Mm-hmm. And then, so we were talking about this before the podcast. So when the candle goes out, the color is extinguished from the movie, and then the smoke dissipates into a train passing by, presumably Jews being transported to where... ever. And so with the extinguishing of the candle through smoke is one of these things that continues to happen throughout the movie, which is interesting. But they use the smoke from the crematorium smokestacks, and that actually isn't a thing in World War II. Germany made a real effort to hide that they were burning the bodies. You know, they didn't want ash falling from the sky. And then the next time you see them lighting candles is, does it actually happen, or is it at the end?
Outside of the girl in the red dress, I think it's only at the end with the lighting of the candles.
Again, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they relight the candles, and that symbolizes the peace and the hope of a Jewish life continuing. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when we dissolve at the very, you know, the epilogue, where we're seeing the actual survivors, it comes back to color. Here we are now, they survived, we do have that life and hope.
Yeah, and then putting rocks on tombstones... and things like that. That's something I learned when I went to Israel. When we went to some of the Holocaust grave sites, you know, because some bodies were shipped to Israel and they were buried there. And there are rocks on a bunch of people's casket, whatever that's called. You know, gravestones. And there are a bunch of rocks everywhere. Rock. I don't actually know what it actually symbolizes, but that's an accurate representation.
Nice. So you're talking about the visuals.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to draw like that old Hollywood comparison. Yeah, please. Some of the things, I don't want to say that they were striking or out of place, because clearly this movie, you know, beautiful period piece, very detailed, the sets, the business, the props, the work, everything, you know, it was a wonderfully dressed movie. Of course, Schindler's introduction has a very... sexy kind of almost James Bond feel to it.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're doing that thing, that old Hollywood thing where it's a close-up but you're just lighting the eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, like, you know, black and white at that time maybe wasn't translating as intended. I'm sure that was the goal.
Yeah, had to have been.
That we want
that
this,
was
this...
a very James Bond.
Yeah, because he's, like, smoking. You, like, see him, like, oh, there's a Nazi pin, but he's looking, like, fine and maybe even a little vampire-like with the slicked hair. Like,
yeah.
My wife got an Eddie Munster vibe from him.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
But I've also never seen such a young Liam Neeson.
So that was like, his first role. Apparently, Spielberg saw him on Broadway, and his charisma reminded him of Schindler and thought, this is the perfect person. It was also Fine's first role in a major film as well. Nice. So he got, because he wanted to get nobodies, because apparently they had auditioned, wait for it, fucking Kevin Costner.
No.
As Schindler, which would have turned it into a dad flick.
He would have been so much younger at that time, too.
Yeah, that would have been really weird,
I
think.
A dad flick.
They also interviewed Warren Beatty, and Warren Beatty was far enough along in the process that he made it to a script reading, but according to Spielberg, Beatty was dropped because, quote, Warren would have played it like Oscar Schindler through Warren Beatty. And the third person that they list as auditioning for the role, Mel Gibson.
Which was a
great
dodge.
Good save, yeah.
Wow, in an alternate history. This movie,
oh my god.
Nothing could taint this movie except had they cast Mel Gibson as Oscar Schindler.
Fucking wild.
Oof.
That would have been absolutely, that would have been a travesty. But yeah, so that was both Liam Neeson and Fiennes' first roles, and they both really actually look like the real people.
I was gonna ask if Fiennes' character
Eamon Goeth,
if that was an actual general from the story.
It was.
It was a placeholder.
No, that's a real guy, and he was the real leader of that work camp. Prashow? Is that what it was?
That sounds right.
He was the real leader of that camp, and the villa is still there. So Spielberg went on a trip to Poland to see all the places first for the blocking, to get an idea how the story was going to get told. They even caught that was really Auschwitz too.
Wow.
Yeah, in the film, and so the work camp that they had to rebuild in a rock quarry. But other than that, most of those places were actual places. In Poland.
I hope you're enjoying the gentle sounds of the rain in the background. Seems like an appropriate tone setter for
this
dramatic journey.
Yeah. Do you have any more old Hollywood isms?
No, mainly just the kind of like the ballroom stuff. How they keep going back to the ballroom. And again, the Citizen Kane comparisons with Oscar Schindler, that he's just this beloved magnate in the community that's always like at a nice classy club looking fine with a bunch of ladies around him. Even at the beginning when someone's like, who is that man? And it's like, that's Oscar Schindler. Like,
that's Oscar Schindler, of course.
Yeah, and he even has like a Bond, James Bond moment or two like within the movie as he's...
Yeah. I liked how in the beginning, I mean, from a business standpoint, so it starts off with the juxtaposition of him getting his money and putting all his rings and stuff on. So there's all this opulence that's going on as the Jews are, you know, being taken out of their homes. So that juxtaposition is really not fun, but
poignant.
And so when Schindler shows up at the party and... he clearly must have been a mastermind of business and had this plan. He's like, I'm going to go to that SS party and I'm going to give those guys drinks and I'm going to invite the girl over. And so I think when they're like, that's Oscar Schindler, it's kind of new because that's him meeting everyone. And that's why the table keeps growing and getting bigger. Okay. And all of a sudden he's super fun because he's buying everyone drinks. And that's why he's taking all the photos.
Okay. Like garnering their trust with, like by throwing them parties, kind of getting like in a Great Gatsby sort of way.
Exactly.
It's like, you've never heard of this guy. He's amazing.
This parties are the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, historically though, it turns out that Schindler was, a German spy after World War I. So he was already shoulder to shoulder with these guys. He didn't need to throw this kind of party.
So in history, he had the kind of clearance to make these moves without suspicion.
Yeah.
But the movie kind of takes it the other way and shows it where...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think you had to build the story. Like, why the hell would he have this kind of idea rather than saying, that's Oscar Schindler. He was a spy. He did these things, you know.
Sure, like background. Let's just meet him and go from there. Kind of give him a start to finish arc. Like, starts as a war profiteering, you know, industrialist, and then employs Jews, sees what's happening, tries to save them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It works better.
It's much better storytelling-wise. I think my favorite aspect of the movie is use of silence with the visuals. You know, like when you see all of the trunks in Krakow, just out. There's no sound. It's just the trunks. You know, there's a lot of visual cues. I was reading that Spielberg had initially wanted the movie to be in German and Polish with subtitles. But he thought he didn't want people fucking reading the whole time. He wanted them seeing what was happening. And so that's why there's a blend of unsubtitled German and Polish mixed in with English storytelling.
That's something I was curious about, that when we watched it with subtitles, a lot of the German soldier speak was not translated.
Correct.
They would just subtitle the German, which I suppose alienates the viewer, kind of puts you in the situation of they're shouting things and like, we don't understand, but we know it's bad.
And that has a duality in storytelling purpose, like particularly when they're expelling the Jews from the ghetto. There's all of the loud conundrum of German yelling and dogs barking. You know, not everyone spoke German, you know, and so they're trying to put you in those shoes of not knowing what the fuck is going on. There's just a cacophony of sound and visuals. So I think it was just awesome to see, you know, really make you feel that you're just as lost in the situation as some of the Jews are.
And a lot of the visual elements were very moving. One that really struck me was after they evacuated the ghetto and all the loot was piled up.
Oh, yeah.
And they had the suitcases and the shoes and the teeth, and they were making other Jews look through the stuff. And, and I don't know, man.
Yeah.
It's just like the idea you have that you know was there, but sort of for me, the most jarring thing was seeing the scale and just, you know, setting up the table. Yes, yes. Yeah. And like the way it operated and really seeing that, you know, put to the screen in such a grand scale, you have all the different movements of kind of the processes of this, you know, like the final solution, you know, like, okay, first we're going to evict him, then we're going to evict him from that place, then we're going to go to the work camps. And, oh God, like the physical scene where they're all like naked and they're playing the records and making them run around singling them out and just these huge sweeping things.
And then they played, did you notice how that was a kid's song that all the kids knew? That they were playing when they were rounding up all the kids onto the...
Yeah, they were singing.
On the trucks, and it's my understanding that they did a lot of stuff like that to alleviate the fears of the Jews. You know, again, like the story that was told by one of the women in the work camp saying that they were giving them bars of soap, you know, before they went into the showers to make sure the Jews think it's good, you know, to make it easier for them to get there.
Yeah.
I've seen models of Auschwitz and certain camps, and when you get off the train, they call it like a cow's tunnel or whatever, so they basically funnel towards the end with the final solution. You would get off the train, and the ramp would go down, and they would make you take off all your clothes, and they would funnel you down this way around the outside of the camp directly into the gas chambers. You know, so it was... just boom, 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 a total machine of murder. It's captivating and it's sickening watching it visually. You know, and I think there's a lot of things that are missed in school. Like this, I feel like this movie should almost be a senior document that maybe seniors in high school should be allowed to see. Because you're able to watch rated R movies, you know, make them all sit down and watch 3 hours of this.
Or at least scenes of those big mechanical set pieces happening. Yeah. Like, here's this will give you an idea of what it was like, you know, at each of these stages. Because it's something, you know, you do learn about, but seeing it, I hit a point halfway through where I'm like, okay, this is the movie. Like, this is the one, you know, visual document of, like, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same as maybe with a World War II movie, except there are more of those.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of, like, the one. So, yeah, I think it should be mandatory viewing, or at least scenes of the movie.
Parts of it, like, just to sell the gravity of the situation. Because the further away we get, the less people remember it. And it's the, you know, the trope of history, you know, it rewrites itself and it's like, oh, here we go again. Which is why this movie, I don't know if you knew this, was re-released in theaters last year.
20th anniversary? Or no.
25th. The 25th anniversary. God.
It's been so long.
Yeah, and Spielberg said, I'm happy it's being re-released now because it's not like a parenthetical piece, like this kind of hate is out there again. You know, we're literally living in a time when people probably should be watching this movie, which is one reason why they re-released it in theaters for the 25th anniversary.
Yeah. The cultural relevance today, you know, seeing a resurgence in that kind of talk, anti-Semitism, and I was curious where that sentiment was in the 90s, if there was, I mean, obviously it's always been out there, we have technology, so we're more aware of it and more connected, but I imagine that there have always been Nazi cells in America to some degree.
I'm sure there are. You know, that reminds me. When I worked at the UPS store, I was speaking to a director, actually, who ironically or unironically looks like Spielberg. great guy. Totally awesome dude. Older Jew. And he was working on adapting a book about the German Nazi cinema underground that was here in LA, because they started picking off certain people and learning from the masters of cinema and then using Hollywood back in Germany for propaganda.
When was this?
This was during the World War II.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know, like, Inglourious Basterds gives you a little sense of there's clearly a ton of propaganda movies.
Yeah. And so it's funny how a lot of things can be tied back to cinema in Hollywood. And so to see cinema used in a way to look back on things of the past is always kind of a fun historical adventure, you know? Mm. Historical fiction's great, and this movie, I think, is a great piece of historical fiction.
One thing specifically that struck me about it, if we want to put this in the context of a 90s movie release, was the level of violence and that just the jarring visuals. We weren't shying away from anything.
Mm-hmm.
They really showed it all. That wasn't... I mean, I'm sure there were movies in the 90s that tried to... Last of the Mohicans is one that I remember watching,
okay,
where we got some of the
violence. I've actually never seen Last of the Mohicans.
I like it. I've been meaning to revisit it. It's been, like, 20 years. But, DDL.
DDL.
Oh, Lewis.
Oh, yeah! My man!
Yeah.
My man.
It was a good one. But I guess you think of later movies, like a Saving Private Ryan or something, where you really get this disorienting, boots on the ground, first-person view of the chaos.
Yeah.
That's just, there's no rhyme or reason to it.
And then to that point, you can see where Spielberg got that initial D-Day scene, storming the beaches of Normandy from.
Yeah.
Which is, it's cool to see that, because I had seen Schindler's List first when I was younger.
Mm.
So when I saw Saving Private Ryan, when I was a little bit older, you're able to make these sort of comparisons.
Yeah, and it's certainly been something that influenced cinema that came after it.
Mm-hmm.
That, as I was saying, on this kind of scale, you didn't really get that level of, authenticity and chaos. And it was, really, really interesting to see.
Yeah, it's just such a powerful document. And I think one of my favorite scenes is the... when he gets the Perlmans, the girl who comes over and she's like, my mother and father are old and they're starting to kill the old ones.
Yes.
And he's a dick doer.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably to show if God forbid anyone's listening, that he's not doing this.
Right.
And then he went and got him and brought him over. There always seemed to be this okay, don't fucking tell me because there's people outside listening,
Mm-hmm.
But sure.
And that was one of two moments, there was the, God bless you, the old man, one-armed man.
The one-armed guy.
These times where people, see through Schindler's lies and facade, and they know that he is a Jewish sympathizer and that he is saving people, but he doesn't want anyone to say that out loud, so it really rattles him on both occasions.
Yeah.
He's like, what does it look like, Don't fucking, don't let these people come and tell me exactly what I'm doing. We all gotta not say that thing.
Don't you
or
get
it won't
it?
Work.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Schindler. The little boy. I think my favorite character was the rabbi, the sweet guy. He was the hinge maker.
Yes.
He, I think, is probably one of the better characters.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he kind of goes through it all and sees it all, and then he gets the gratification of leading a Sabbath again,
mm-hmm.
Which is just really, really sweet, I thought.
Yeah. On that note, one of the very few criticisms that I could unearth for this movie, 97 on Rotten Tomatoes, pretty universally beloved. And I can sort of see it in such a long movie of occasionally feeling disconnected from the individual Jews that are going through all of this. You definitely get the vignettes, and the rabbi is a great example of one that is consistent throughout.
Yeah.
But again, in the 3-hour line, there was the guy... with the girl that wouldn't go in the sewers, and we get to check in with him a few times.
Yeah, and he was in the beginning selling the metal jars of jam or whatever that was.
Yeah.
I agree, and I think that was the Shoah guy's criticism, is it focused on a German.
Yes, and the Jew was just kind of the character, all the Jews.
Yes.
And those big set pieces I was talking about, that's sort of them as the character. And I, Ben Kingsley was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And for a movie that long, we definitely check in on a lot of the lives that are being affected and, surviving through this.
Yeah.
But as that criticism...
I can see that.
I can sort of see it too. That maybe nowadays, if it was made, you would definitely have to have a full B plot of someone on the inside and spend the time with them enduring.
Yeah.
Because having, that was a jarring juxtaposition for me, is that you have this industrialist Nazi playboy with all the money in the world who seemingly has very little on the line, seemingly, obviously, there's huge consequences if anyone figures out what he's doing, but he has that luxury as a non-Jew to not be the voyeur of the situation. He's clearly orchestrating, mm-hmm. you know, they're saving them,
mm-hmm.
but balancing that against the horror that was happening going on to the Jews, and not getting a man on the ground to sort of follow that story, I think, is, you know.
It's probably very 90s-ish. I can see the criticism.
Sure.
I'm too close.
Yeah. That's why I like...
So that's a great take. I didn't even consider it.
And truly it was something that, to me, not that, again, you know, it was long.
It's very long. It's a
rough ride. Yeah. So as I was going
through it... It's not fun.
It got to that point where after you've seen so many executions and so much brutal manhandling of the Jewish communities that I wouldn't want to say it was numbing, but you get a little... Mm-hmm. acclimated to it, and it sort of loses the effect. And maybe if you had an individual human story, that might not have happened.
Do you think, though, that that's the point?
To some degree.
Yeah.
But, like you said, spending the time with the rabbi and the maid that
Ellen Hirsch,
you definitely followed her business and got a good sense of that. Mm-hmm. And those scenes were super gratifying, like when Schindler kisses her and, like, you know, talks to her. And
yeah.
The scene where Geth is, like, talking to himself about raping her.
Yeah.
And, like, showing what a fucking monster he is. Like, you know.
Literally in his head, mm-hmm. having this argument, and then scapegoating the Hirsch.
Yeah.
Scapegoating Hirsch.
But there's also the sense that you have so much to tell, so many situations that did occur that you kind of need to break it up with
mm-hmm.
characters that we're not super familiar with. Like the kids hiding at the camp when they were taking the kids away.
Yeah.
Or
in the latrine.
Everyone hiding in the ghetto,
that
crazy scene where, you know, they're finding everyone's hiding places and waiting for sound, and the one German's like playing the classical piano.
The Baroque. What an awesome use of Baroque.
And just the music in general, a lot of the times has that effect of being spooky and eerily calm and classical and familiar while just hellish things are happening on screen.
Yeah. The theme, John Williams' theme, is probably one of my favorites of his. And I like that throughout the movie, different instruments are playing it, which I always thought was kind of a fun through line throughout the whole movie.
Mm.
Was hearing the theme as just a piano or like a sad trumpet or
there's
the full
like a
orchestra.
Classical guitar version.
The classical
near
guitar
the end
version.
That
I
really enjoyed.
I think one of the most powerful points of the movie for me is how every time shit got bad, there would always be a group of Jews and they're like, well, it can't get any worse.
Yes.
And you're like,
but I know.
It's going to.
It already happened. I read the book. I know the history. Yeah. Like, it's, oh God.
Yeah.
And that's something too, that you don't really consider a revisit from your high school history or whatever, is the psychological torture of it all. Like, it wasn't enough to just have a war effort.
The dehumanizing.
Or have, yes. And you see all those steps, certainly with the arbitrary executions that mm-hmm. are going on. Sorry, man, I just...
No, it's totally good.
I went back there and I kind of lost my train of thought.
Yeah, it's... I've seen this movie every year now for a handful of years, not to mention a few times when I was younger, so I just watch it once a year for the holiday Yom HaShoah, which is when you revisit the Holocaust, you know, mm-hmm. remember it. Although I think one of these years I want to watch Shoah. It's impossible to find on any service.
Mm.
It's a Criterion movie.
Is there a subscription for that?
Well, unfortunately, so there was Filmstruck, right? Filmstruck was the Criterion's subscription service. And it went under. It was great. It was fucking awesome. You could literally go sci-fi French, and you would get a French sci-fi movie from the 40s, you know, which is crazy sounds and things like that. However, due to some funding, I think actually Spielberg is a funder of Criterion. They're re-releasing a new version in April. And I'm for sure going to sign up for it.
Nice.
But yeah, the show is like a 9-hour journey. And it's hard enough watching 3 hours of Schindler's List. I couldn't imagine doing 9 hours over a couple nights. Like, what am I doing?
Just think of it like Lord of the Rings, only really sad.
Only extra sad, yeah.
My favorite part of the movie was Ralph Fiennes as the villain.
So good.
Just masterful acting and you know, we know him as Voldemort, and he's...
Yeah. Just... That was his first fucking major role. Are you kidding me?
Okay, so my wife told me that he was cast apparently because of his dangerous sexual energy.
Oh, well...
That might have been part of, you know, for his look anyway. And that he apparently drank a ton of Guinness to get that, like, soggy kind of beer gut that he was, you know, sticking out so frequently.
So, I wonder if I'm going to be able to find this. Look at this photo of Eamon Goeth.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
We're looking at a picture of him on the balcony at the villa with the sniper rifle without a shirt on, and it's pretty damn accurate as to what we saw in the movie.
But I think your wife is right. There was a dangerous sexual energy from him.
Yeah.
But he does look just like this motherfucker.
Yeah. Super, like, creepy, dark, handsome look. But just everything about his... It was written extremely well. His character for his pathos, kind of his journey, and gave a really crazy lens to that, whatever it was that was fueling the Nazis, that he was so indifferently just hateful towards the Jews, but he was also, he seemed like a drunk, spoiled frat boy. Like, why is the top down? And he was just getting shit-faced all the time.
Because it's cold, yeah.
And he wasn't, I figured. That's but right. It was also pretty sexy, a lot of smoking and drinking throughout.
Yeah.
But just, I don't know, just everything about all of his kind of deliveries, and you're seeing his insecurity and his internal struggle, and it really peaks with that drunk scene where him and Schindler are talking about the nature of power.
Yeah.
And how he clearly thinks power is just control and murder
and fear,
and that's the wrong kind of power, and like Schindler has the better kind of power, the power of mercy, and even when he briefly dabbles in being benevolent and, you know, pardoning people.
I pardon you.
Like that idea is only instant, you know, for a second crosses his mind, and clearly that's not the kind of power that his personality is disposed to. But he's also fucking a wreck, you know, like drinking himself to death. He's not happy. He should be. He's getting exactly what he thinks he wants, which is, you know, revenge on the Jew and a position of power in a camp of his own and a villa, but none of it satisfies him.
Yes.
And it was so... I laughed out loud when he died.
Oh, yeah.
At the very end. Just because, you know, one, his last words are Heil Hitler.
Yep.
It's like, you lost, dude. War's over. You don't have to stick it out for this crazy meth head. And then they couldn't kick the stool from under him to hang him.
I didn't look it up. Do you think that was intentional? I feel like that might have been just...
like a goof on the movie that they didn't get the kick on
the
first take.
They didn't get the kick right, and then it worked. You know?
Yeah, I considered it.
How sadistic, right?
If it was intentional, it was brilliant, because it makes his death just that much more pathetic.
Yeah.
That even the execution itself was like, they fucked it up.
Yeah. So good. So, so good.
Yeah.
I'm glad that fucker died.
Mm-hmm. But in that Christoph Waltz and Inglourious Basterds kind of way, just seeing a masterful actor really embody, you know, it can't be easy to play.
It's got
to
be hard.
Something so evil, but to do it so well, not a credit to the Nazis, a credit to his acting. That he really, like, channeled all of that in a...
I mean, without getting too deep in it, we could totally blow this open, you know. But
please.
It's just, it's crazy that people like Eamon Goeth or Goethe or whatever were able to think this way about an entirety of people.
Mm.
You know, the sheer machine of propaganda and the war effort and all these things that they singled out, not just the Jews, but the Gypsies and I think the Romanis, you know. There were other people that died in the Holocaust. And it's intense to see someone play someone so perfectly who probably did, in fact, really feel this way. For what reason, though?
Yeah. And again, that's what I love, the conflict that you get. Not conflict of what's right and wrong, is of how he can continue to do this. That it's not sustainable, that clearly this kind of hate is not an answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to fix your country or make you happy, but everybody has already committed to it. They've, like, crossed the line of pure evil, so they almost have to reinforce it to themselves and remind themselves and each other that, like, no, Jews aren't people. He kissed a Jewish girl, that whole scene.
Judenrat.
Like, it's, it's policy now.
Yeah, like exactly. And that's, I wish people could see the connection to now of if you just did Command F, and change Muslim, I mean, change Jew to Muslim, you know, or immigrant, you know, we're this close to this kind of stuff with the border stuff.
Yeah, and it's so strange. You saw like the internment camps for the Japanese during World War II, and that clearly as a country we've
got our own problems.
We've dipped a toe in this shit before, and the thought that we maybe haven't learned from it, like, no, let's have an immigrant registry or a Muslim registry. Exactly. Let's put everybody
on a list
in camps at the border. Like, it's really baffling that we didn't learn the lesson. We don't, like, as a country, I feel like we have a huge problem.
We do.
Really looking our history in the face and, you know, bettering ourselves from it. Because as long as the money's flowing, we don't need to trouble ourselves with it.
Mm-hmm.
But when times are bad, you know, oh, wouldn't you know, there's Nazis again. There's Unite the Right. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what?
Like, when the chips are down.
Again? Just,
yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Do you have more things to cover?
So sometimes we talk about representation and, you know, the more problematic, you know, 2019 lens.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a very like singular all in its own work, so it's tough to see. I do think it was fine, but like Schindler fucked. Like, there was always a naked lady in his bed.
Oh, he was fucking.
Yeah, the whole time. And again, that's the whole, the Jews Playboy. Are getting exterminated and this guy's fucking
in their home.
Yeah, every time. And he was married, I guess, and had an estranged wife.
Yeah.
That, I laughed out loud at that scene when she was like, as long as no one will ever mistake me for anyone other than Mrs. Schindler, if you can do that, I'll stay. And then cut to her on the train. Bye! Yeah,
bye! Ooh, I'd rather not.
It's a nice levity. And and whatever, it is what it is.
Like, yeah.
But a lot of boobies.
A lot of boobies.
And I did appreciate that they had female Nazis.
Yeah. Scary.
That was not something I was even aware of in terms of when women were allowed to serve in military positions in any country.
Yeah. Oh, shit, yeah.
But the fact that, and maybe they were specifically handling the women and children at the camps, that seemed to kind of be the case, that you would see the Nazi lady soldiers with the children or the women. But the fact that it was there was, I don't want to say it's good that there were women Nazis, but in terms, you know, for inclusion's sake, I don't think any other war movie, you know, being made really ever showed that kind of thing.
Yeah. True. Very true.
Or maybe they were just starting to in the 90s.
Maybe. Yeah, I wonder if they were real. I'm gonna look that up after this.
Yeah.
Curious. I was looking at just historical photos, and there were after the liberation, they're outside of one of the work camps, British and American soldiers were overseeing German soldiers refilling ditches where they killed Jews. And they were like, it was really hot out at the time. And so they asked for a rest. And so they were laying face down in the ditches. That was how they were allowed to rest.
Oh, wow.
Because we were trying to show them, like,
like, stick their nose in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Can't be merciful.
Just a little anecdote there.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's pretty, that's street justice, man.
Yeah, really.
Do you want to do band?
Did you do any quotes for this one?
I did. Okay, let's do, you want to do quotes first?
Sure.
Okay, you start.
Goodbye, Jews!
Yeah, that girl. They don't even know what it is. Something like an emblem of a writing club when they're talking about putting the star on the Jews.
Mm. You're a musician? I'd find a good place to hide.
Yeah. I didn't write any, like, fun ones.
Oh, okay.
So I'll let you just read yours.
I wouldn't want to say that they're fun, but they stood out to me as good lines, quotable lines.
Yeah.
That, totally. Either in or out of context were worth noting. Earlier on in the movie, money's still money. No, it's not. And I gotta do Liam Neeson in his Taken voice, obviously. Amon talking to Stern, look at me. Silent for 5 seconds. And then he walks out. Just so cryptic. So weird. No one wants to look at that fucking guy.
Yep.
So evil. Cry and I will have you arrested, I swear to God.
I swear to God.
You know who I am? I'm Schindler. Bond. James Bond.
Yep.
how many cigarettes have you smoked tonight? Too many. Hey, ain't that always the truth? And that's about all I got for the
there were some good lines. That musician line is pretty solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, I think it's entirely quotable, the whole conversation Schindler has with drunken
Amon. Oh, about power. About
the nature of, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and then obviously the whoever saves one life saves the world entire. That's good.
Yeah, that's great.
So the band I chose, Michael Bolton. Because he was a big-time hit in the 90s. Like, I think it was like 91. And he's also a Jew. So there you go.
All right. I didn't know that about Michael Bolton.
Neither did I until I was Googling bands.
Interesting. I went ahead and forewent trying to find something that touched on, you know, the historical, meaningful Jewish aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I went with Pearl Jam.
Okay.
Okay, because it's like 90s, prolific, long career, long catalog. Some of the songs are maybe a little longer than they need to be, but it's wow, good, solid stuff.
Nice. Nice. So, do you want to do alternate title?
Sure.
That's our new segment.
Yeah, just which, you know, again, not trying to joke around on this one, but
let me just Google. My alternate title is When Brian Mills Meets Voldemort. The Taken prequel.
Nice. Yeah, some bizarro timeline where these two same people exist, but in Nazi Poland.
Yep.
All right, mine was Big Trouble in Nazi Krakow.
Wow! That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's fucking awesome.
It was either that or Citizen Kane meets Casablanca. But way darker with Nazis.
But way darker with Nazis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Naturally, I would recommend that anyone watch this movie. Like I said, should be required viewing.
Yeah, just I agree.
Could not be more relevant for an American, especially today. You know, you revisit it every year.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those that I don't know when I'm gonna be in the mood for this ride again.
Yeah,
definitely. If you have not seen it, check it out.
Definitely check it out. And yeah, did you cry?
Yeah,
I cry every time.
It's when he has his breakdown. That he could have saved more lives.
Oh, and yeah. So hard. That one.
And when the scene with the classical guitar playing, I think it was just a bunch of people on the streets, like, walking. But something about what had maybe just happened in the movie.
Yeah.
And it was all... It just added up. It, you know, the dam broke.
Mm-hmm. It happens.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This has been Stay Cool Forever. It'll be more fun next time, but...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're, you know, again, doing the classics, so this isn't going to have as much of the 90s joshing on really dated things. These are classics that kind of have already been deemed to have stood the test of time.
Yeah.
We're just going to give them a revisit.
Give them our go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you made it this far, thank you. You can catch us on Podmas, Pippa, Google Play, Apple iTunes, Spotify...
Email us at staycoolforever@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts.
Yeah, and let us know your thoughts. Let us know if you got a theme that you want us to cover next time or if you have any questions.
Stay cool.
Stay cool.